Good morning. I'd like to tell you a story about a town. This story starts in the summer of 1961 and with a physician by the name of Dr. Stephen Wolfe. Dr. Wolfe was the chairman of the Department of Medicine at the University of Oklahoma Medical School in the United States, but he spent his summers vacationing at a farm in Pennsylvania. In the summer of 1961, when Dr. Wolfe was vacationing in Pennsylvania, he happened to meet a local doctor who made a curious remark to him. The doctor said that he had been a practicing physician in the area for more than 17 years, and that in that entire time, he had never seen a single case of heart disease from a particular town in his community. The doctor said that he had seen plenty of cases of heart disease from towns all around that particular town, but not one from the town itself. The name of that town was called Rosetto. Rosetto was a small Italian-American town of approximately 1,600 people, located in the foothills of eastern Pennsylvania. The town was founded in the late 1800s by a group of villagers that immigrated to the United States from a small town in Italy called Rosetto Valfertore, where they had worked in the marble quarries surrounding the town. Upon arriving in the United States and seeking work which they knew how to do, the villagers settled near the slate quarries of eastern Pennsylvania and began to build their town. But in listening to the physician's claims about the supposed absence of heart disease in Rosetto, Dr. Wolfe was skeptical. This was, after all, the early 1960s, years before the advent of cholesterol-lowering medications and aggressive campaigns to fight heart disease. Heart attacks were an epidemic in the United States. In fact, they were the single leading cause of death for men under the age of 65. Dr. Wolfe thought that it was impossible for someone to have been a practicing physician in an area for almost 20 years and to have never seen a single case of heart attack in a particular town. But the physician's comments had aroused Dr. Wolfe's curiosity, and for the remainder of the summer, he began scouring death certificates from residents of Rosetto, going back as many years as he could. Dr. Wolfe was surprised by what he found. Just as the physician had predicted, Dr. Wolfe could not find one person under the age of 65 from Rosetta who had ever died from a heart attack, no matter how many years back in time he looked. In addition, the death rate from heart attacks for people over the age of 65 in Rosetta was something like half the United States national average. In fact, the death rate from all causes in Rosetta was something like 30 to 35% lower than what it should have been. Dr. Wolfe was mystified. He approached the mayor of Rosetto and told him that his town represented something of a medical mystery to him, and that him and his colleagues from the University of Oklahoma wanted to do a full-blown study on Rosetto to determine why its residents seemingly had an immunity to fatal heart attacks. Over the next year, Dr. Wolfe and his staff met with nearly two-thirds of Rosetto's 1,600 inhabitants, conducting physical examinations, preparing extensive family and medical histories, and performing laboratory results. Dr. Wolfe and his team were astonished by what they found. In addition to having virtually no heart disease, there was no incidence, Rosetto, of suicide, no incidence of homicide, no alcoholism, no drug addiction, no dementia, no ulcers, no mental illness, no nothing. The people of this small little town were simply dying of old age, and that's it. Dr. Wolfe, first thought was that perhaps the issue was diet. The answer was diet. That somehow the residents of Rosetto had hung on to some old dietary practices from Italy that somehow made them healthier than Americans. But they quickly realized that that wasn't the case. Rosettans cooked their food with lard, as opposed to the more heart-healthy olive oil which they had used back in Italy. In addition, their pasta and pizza dishes were loaded up with ham and salami and cheese and eggs. In fact, when dietitians on Dr. Wolfe's team analyzed the Rosettans' eating habits, they found that a whopping 41% of their total caloric intake came from saturated fats. Someone from Rosetto. In fact, many Rosettans struggled with obesity. In addition, many of them smoked heavily and drank large amounts of alcohol. Dr. Wolfe then wondered if perhaps the answer was genetics, that somehow these Rosettans had immigrated from a particularly hardy stock of Italians that somehow were immune to heart attacks. So to analyze this, Dr. Wolfe and his team tracked down relatives of Rosettans that had settled in other parts of the United States and studied their rates of heart disease. They were approximately twice that of the people who lived in Rosetto. Dr. Wolf then wondered that maybe there was just something around the water of eastern Pennsylvania that made it a healthy place to live. So to analyze this, Dr. Wolf analyzed the residents of a number of towns around Rosetto, each of which was approximately the same size as Rosetto and served by the same doctors and hospitals. The rates of heart attacks in those towns was 3 times that of what it was in Rosetto. Slowly over time, what Dr. Wolf and his colleagues came to realize was that the secret of Rosetto wasn't diet or exercise or genetics or the place where Rosetto was located. It was the nature of the town itself. As Dr. Wolf and his colleagues continued to walk around the town, they began to see why. They saw it in how the kitchens of Rosettans' homes were filled with neighbors who often dropped by unannounced in the evenings and stayed for hours into the night, laughing and drinking and talking. He saw it in how Rosettans stopped to talk with each other in the street, how they cooked for each other in their backyards, how they shared half of the homemade wine that they had made for their families with their friends and their neighbors. He saw it in the calming and the unifying effect of the local church called Our Lady of Mount Carmel, to which more than 80% of Rosetto's residents belonged, and whose festivals and street fairs were opportunities for the entire community to celebrate. He saw it in how Rosetto had 22 different service and civic clubs, one club for every 70 residents, and how the social life of the town revolved around these clubs. He saw it in how Rosetto was physically constructed, how almost all the homes in Rosetto were built close together and close to the street, how they almost all had front porches, where families would sit in the evenings and on weekends talking to neighbors in adjoining homes and passers-by on the street. He saw it in how every evening after dinner, the ancient Italian ritual of la passeggiata, or the promenade, would take place, where residents would spill out of their homes onto the street and take long, leisurely walks up and down the sidewalk, stopping at friends' homes to say hello, to gossip, and to share the news of the day. He saw it in how the act of people breaking bread together remained an important communal ritual in Rosetto, how on Sunday evenings all across the town, extra chairs were drawn up and extra leaves added to dining tables to accommodate friends and neighbors for a traditional Sunday evening dinner of spaghetti with meatballs. And he saw it in how one of Rosetto's strongest community traditions was that of helping friends as well as family members. How if a family or an individual in the community was in trouble, the entire neighborhood would rally around to help take care of them. And through all of this, what Dr. Wolf and his team came to realize was that they had stumbled upon a magical place. A place where the sense of community was so deeply practiced and the bonds of neighborhood so strong that they had essentially inoculated people against the pressures and diseases of modern life. Dr. Wolf realized that the secret of Rosetto was not something that could be seen through a microscope and was something which was beyond the focus of traditional medical research, but something which was still nonetheless profoundly true. The fact that people are nourished by other people. The fact that a sense of neighborliness was good not just for the body politic, but for the human body as well. And that a sense of social connection could by itself overcome the pattern of illness and mortality in American life. In 2011, the Vancouver Foundation embarked upon a project to determine the one community issue about which residents in Metro Vancouver were most concerned so that the foundation could determine where best to focus its time and resources. To gauge this, representatives from the foundation met with over 100 business, academic, and community leaders all across Metro Vancouver. They surveyed nearly 300 community organizations with which the foundation worked, and it conducted 6 public forums with private residents. In each of these consultations, the foundation asked community leaders and residents to identify the one community issue in Metro Vancouver that they cared most about and about which they were most concerned. The foundation was stunned by what it found. As opposed to identifying issues such as affordability or transportation or homelessness, which the foundation had expected, community leaders and residents indicated that their single greatest worry was a growing sense of social disconnection, loneliness, and isolation, which existed within the Metro Vancouver area. This sense of disconnection, they indicated, was resulting in a deepening malaise in which more and more people were retreating from civic and community life. Based on these consultations, the foundation decided to conduct a broader community survey to find out more about these issues. It retained a survey research firm, and in the spring of 2012, it surveyed nearly 4,000 residents in 17 different communities across Metro Vancouver, including here in New West. The results of the survey confirmed what the foundation had found in its community consultations. First, the survey revealed a significant sense of social isolation within the Metro Vancouver area. Nearly 33% of survey respondents, one out of three, indicated that they found Metro Vancouver a difficult place to make friends. One out of four, more than 25% of these 4,000 people, reported feeling more lonely and alone than they would like. Second, the survey found that our connections with neighbors, while cordial, was quite weak. While most respondents indicated that they knew the names of at least two of their neighbors, almost 60% indicated that they had never done any type of small favor for any one of their neighbors, such as collecting their mail or their newspapers when they were away on vacation. And almost 75%, three out of four, indicated that they had never socialized with one of their neighbors, such as by going to their house for dinner or inviting a neighbor over to theirs for a drink. Third, the survey found that as a result of these and other factors, residents of Metro Vancouver were in fact beginning to withdraw from civic and community life. In fact, fewer than 25% of respondents in Metro Vancouver, less than one in four, indicated that they had participated in any type of neighborhood or community project during the past year, such as a community food drive or a neighborhood garden. As many of you know from reading the papers, these findings captured the attention of both the local and the national press. In June of 2012, the Vancouver Sun ran a five-piece cover story on these findings entitled, quote, Growing Apart. The Globe and Mail published a similar article entitled, Alone, So Alone in Vancouver. And the Calgary Herald dubbed Vancouver, quote, Lonely Town. So, what are we to do about this increasing sense of loneliness and isolation that exists in our midst and in our community? At the outset, I would submit to you that I believe that, like most social issues, the issue of social disconnection in Metro Vancouver has two faces and thus two potential solutions, one institutional and one individual. To use a market metaphor, I believe that we need to work on increasing both the supply of opportunities for us to socially connect with each other as well as the demand for those opportunities. Institutional actors like politicians and urban planners and technology experts can help us, I believe, with the first part of that equation, namely increasing the supply of opportunities for us to be able to connect socially with each other. So, for example, politicians can invest in public spaces like parks and community centers that will facilitate casual socializing with friends and neighbors. Urban planners, for example, can design transportation systems that reduce commute time so that we can more easily socialize with people who live in other parts of the metro area. And technology experts, for example, can help us to find additional ways to connect with each other on the internet, particularly in ways that supplement and reinforce our face-to-face connections as opposed to replacing them. But I believe that an equally important, if not far more important, role lies with all of us in increasing the demand for opportunities to connect socially with other people. And in this regard, I believe that a potentially significant opportunity lies revealed in the answers to one question given on the Vancouver Foundation survey. One of the questions that the foundation had asked was aimed at trying to identify the obstacles that prevented people from getting to know their neighbors and other people in their community. While the most common reason given by respondents was that they seldom saw their neighbors, the second most common reason, given by nearly a third of respondents, was simply that they preferred to be by themselves and had little interest in getting to know their neighbors or other people in their community. Vancouver's Surveys Foundation does not shed light on why nearly a third of the people surveyed did not perceive it to be in their own self-interest to get to know the neighbors or other people in their community. I'm sure that many reasons likely figure into that. But I wonder if perhaps that fact is also reflective of a larger dynamic that we see sometimes in our culture, and that is a failure by many of us to appreciate how truly important our sense of social connection to other people really is. In fact, scientific research has consistently demonstrated that we human beings, particularly in the West, vastly overestimate the value and the importance of material things on our happiness, like, for example, money or professional success or possessions, while greatly underestimating the impact of our social relationships. As one example, often believing consciously or unconsciously that happiness lies elsewhere. Many of us, like the Harvard MBA and the Mexican parable of the fisherman, spend tremendous amounts of our time and energy in life pursuing the goal of climbing the corporate ladder and earning more and more money. But the problem with this, of course, is that a voluminous amount of scientific data demonstrates that more money does not lead to more happiness, except at lower ends of the income scale. In other words, if one has to worry every day about food and shelter and basic necessities, then yes, more money will make you happier. But once one is freed from the middle class and is freed from basic needs, the relationship between wealth and happiness becomes much smaller, and after a point, almost non-existent. Indeed, as many of you may have read in the newspapers, recent research by Daniel Kahneman of Princeton University, the first psychologist ever to win the Nobel Prize in Economics, found that beyond an annual income of approximately $75,000, earning more money brings virtually no increase in happiness whatsoever. Interestingly, this $75,000 tipping point figure was found to apply even in high cost of living cities like New York and Hong Kong, and for our purposes, Vancouver. But how many people do you know that quit trying to make money once they reach an annual income of $75,000? Not many of us. Many of us continue to try to earn more and more, not realizing that the additional income we seek adds very little to our happiness, while at the same time neglecting or ignoring things that could bring lasting satisfaction, like our relationships. Indeed, if the relationship between income and well-being is complicated, the relationship between social connections and happiness is not. Over the past 50 years, a voluminous amount of scientific research has confirmed what Dr. Stephen Wolf and his colleagues stumbled upon by accident in Rosetto many years ago: the fact that our sense of social connection with others is one of the most important, if not the single most important, determinant of both our happiness and our health. For example, in the largest and longest running study ever conducted in the factors that lead to human happiness, researchers studied hundreds of students who entered Harvard University in 1942 and tracked them for more than 70 years, through adulthood, through marriage, through parenthood, and through old age. During the 70 years, subjects were measured from almost every conceivable angle and using almost every available scientific tool, all to determine the factors that contributed to happiness and well-being throughout the lifespan. The Harvard study found that the single factor that most consistently and significantly predicted a person's happiness and health and well-being throughout the course of their life was not income, was not professional accomplishment, was not status or position, but rather was simply the depth and breadth of their social connections. As George Valiant, a Harvard psychiatrist and the study's longtime director, stated when asked to summarize the main findings of the study, in the end, he said, the only thing that matters in life are your relationships with other people. Or as he even more succinctly stated when asked to summarize more than 70 years of research into the determinants of happiness, and as we heard in the children's story this morning, happiness is love, he stated, full stop. But of course, all of you sitting here already know that, because you are sitting here this morning in a church, one of the greatest vehicles ever known for both building community and enhancing personal well-being. Research by Daniel Kahneman, who I mentioned before, was the first psychologist ever to win the Nobel Prize in Economics, demonstrated that the simple act of joining a religious congregation and the sense of fellowship and altruism and social support which it provides produces the same relative gain in happiness as increasing one's income by $50,000 a year and the same health benefits as quitting smoking. But as many of you know, the number of people across North America who belong to religious congregations like this has been steadily dropping since the 1950s. Currently in Metro Vancouver, fewer than 16% of the population belong to or even regularly attend church services at any type of religious institution. As I mentioned previously, in Rosetto, over 80% of the population did. And so, yes, I do believe there is a role to play for politicians and urban planners and internet experts to help us in resolving the problem of social disconnection here in Metro Vancouver. But a politician cannot make us join a religious congregation. An urban planner cannot get us involved in a community fund drive. And a technology expert cannot invite a neighbor over to our house for a drink. Those things, of course, must come from us. And if we do them, we should do them, ironically, not because they are good for the community, although they undoubtedly are, or because we should do them, or because they are the right thing to do. But we should do them because they are good for us. Because you and me and the person sitting next to you are all in our heart of hearts social beings meant to tend and befriend and intertwine our lives with others in all sorts of ways. The good news is that all over Canada, indeed all over the world, people are now increasingly beginning to recognize the power of social connection in their lives. As many of you may have read in the paper, in response to the Vancouver Foundation survey, Vancouver Mayor Gregor Robertson recently convened a joint government-citizen task force to develop strategies for increasing the amount of social connection here in Metro Vancouver. In Great Britain, as you may have also read about, the Minister of Health has declared social loneliness to be the nation's most pressing and fastest-growing public health problem. And the country has embarked upon an ambitious project to map the extent of social isolation as a first step in developing national and local strategies to combat it. In addition to governments, community groups are now getting in the game as well. All across the world, groups are sponsoring grassroots events like annual neighborhood days, where the objective is to encourage neighbors to talk over the fence and get to know each other better. In the United States, more than 2 million people across 25,000 different communities participated in the most recent National Neighborhood Day, on which they held block parties, conducted neighborhood potlucks, had playground cleanups, and held canned food drives. In the city of Chicago alone, where I come from, a neighborhood block party designed to increase social connections in the downtown area attracted more than 18,000 participants. In New Zealand, more than 300,000 people, almost 10% of the entire population of the country, participated recently in National Neighbors Day, on which they held neighborhood pancake breakfasts, progressive dinner parties, and backyard barbecues. And Australia's National Neighbor Day, which over the past 10 years has brought together millions of people across the country for a celebration of community, was officially honored by the United Nations, with plans now being implemented to make World Neighbor Day an official UN observance day. And even developers and urban planners are now getting into the action. All across the country, planned communities are springing up in which a central design strategy, in fact, the central design strategy, is to maximize the number of spontaneous connections that occur between neighbors by placing shops and parks and, in some cases, even public squares in the center of the community where people will invariably bump into and have the chance to talk with each other. But in addition to all these institutional actions, you might wonder, is there anything that people like you and I, just private citizens, can do to boost the level of social connection here in Metro Vancouver? I think that there is, and it just so happens that it turns out that it's one of the simplest and easiest actions to take. In its report to the Vancouver Foundation, the consulting firm which had conducted the Foundation's survey offered a series of recommendations regarding how Metro Vancouver could develop a more caring and involved citizenry. They began by looking at the survey data and identifying those respondents who were consulting firm felt were the kind of residents that Metro Vancouver wished most to inculcate, which they defined as caring and involved residents. These people were defined as people who had demonstrated a psychological and emotional commitment to the community and a willingness to act on its behalf. Then, using a series of complicated and involved statistical techniques, they worked backwards through the survey data to try to identify the baseline variables that most corresponded with the development of those types of citizens. After conducting this extensive analysis, the consulting firm determined that the baseline variable that most correlated and most predicted the development of caring and involved residents was simply the extent to which residents had informal conversations with their neighbors. The firm found a causal pathway existed in which, when people had informal conversations with their neighbors, that often led to them having social get-togethers with their neighbors, which then in turn often led to them developing increased trust in their neighbors, which in turn led them to becoming committed to acting in their best interests. Based upon this extensive statistical analysis, the consulting firm recommended to the foundation that it focus its community building efforts in large part on encouraging residents of Metro Vancouver to have greater numbers of informal conversations with their neighbors. It's interesting and ironic, isn't it, that it took a prominent consulting firm and statistical equation modeling techniques and regression analyses to arrive at the same conclusion that the quarry workers of Rosetto intuitively grasped more than 50 years ago. That simple acts of neighborliness, or as Dr. Stephen Wolfe later wrote in his book, the magical act of stopping to talk to someone on the street, is one of the most powerful drivers of individual and community well-being. And so I would encourage each of you, if you wish, in addition to everything that you are already doing for the community simply by being a member of the Beacon Unitarian Church, to simply consider picking one person in your neighborhood that you don't know very well and making a commitment to get to know them better. That's it. A gift, as it were, to your community and also, I think, to yourself. And if you should choose to do so, I hope that you'll do that remembering the people of Rosetto and the lessons that were taught to us by a small group of Italian immigrants who settled in a little hill town in the foothills of eastern Pennsylvania more than 100 years ago. That we do not have to wait for a sense of community to come to us. That we can build one right where we stand. That we can turn strangers into acquaintances and acquaintances into friends by the simple acts of striking up conversations on elevators, saying hello to people on the street, and nodding to joggers on the same route. And that we should finally treat socializing with our friends and neighbors not as though it was a diversion from the more important tasks at hand, but something which is indispensable to our well-being, both as individuals and as communities. And I believe that if we can do that, then, block by block, neighborhood by neighborhood, town by town, we can begin to restore a sense of community to Metro Vancouver.